This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. After a one-year pandemic delay, the Tokyo Olympics will formally get underway Friday with a scaled-back opening ceremony. The event in Tokyo's Olympic Stadium will only have about 900 dignitaries and other officials attending because of COVID-19 precautions. The Japanese public is broadly opposed to holding the Games, fearing they will worsen Japan's already deteriorating pandemic situation. Tokyo on Thursday reported nearly 2,000 new COVID-19 infections, a six-month high for a city that is already under a state of emergency. In the capital, public viewing areas have been canceled. Bars have been asked to not serve alcohol. The torch relay, an Olympic mainstay, was replaced by online lighting ceremonies. So far, 87 people associated with the Olympics have tested positive for the virus. That includes several athletes whose Olympic dreams were cut short. Still, organizers have played down fears of a cluster infection breaking out in the Olympic Village. The White House says Chinese opposition to a World Health Organization probe into the origins of the coronavirus is irresponsible and dangerous. The White House press secretary called it not a time to be stonewalling. The plan includes the hypothesis the virus could have escaped from a Chinese laboratory, and the proposal includes doing audits of labs and markets in central Chinese city of Wuhan. On Thursday, the vice minister of the National Health Commission told reporters he was taken aback when he read the details. First known cases emerged in Wuhan in December of 2019. The virus was believed to have jumped to humans from animals being sold for food at a city market. For more news, please join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. The United States on Thursday imposed sanctions on a Cuban security minister and an interior minister, ministry special forces unit, that is, for alleged human rights abuses and a crackdown on anti-government protests early this month. Thousands of Cuban state protests a week ago to demonstrate against an economic crisis that has brought shortages of basic goods and power outages. Hundreds of activists were detained. The U.S. Treasury Department said that the sanctions had been placed on the ministers of the Revolutionary Armed Guards and on an Interior Ministry security unit. Washington blames for the crackdown. The Cuban government has blamed the protests on what it calls U.S. finance counter-revolutionaries exploiting economic hardships. U.S. officials have acknowledged that the targeted sanctions may not have much impact. Cubans rarely have U.S. financial dealings and seldom travel to the United States, many limiting the practical impact of such measures. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland promised Thursday that the Justice Department would crack down on gun trafficking corridors as part of a comprehensive approach to combat surging gun violence across the U.S. Garland returned to his hometown of Chicago, where shootings have soared this year, as the Justice Department launched strike forces to confront the rise in gun violence in five cities: Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Besides prioritizing gun crimes, the strike forces will embrace intelligence sharing and prosecutions across jurisdictions, according to the Justice Department officials. Violent crimes, particularly homicides and shootings, are up in many cities around the country. The Biden administration has sought to aid communities hamstrung by violence. Mourners will pay final respects to Haiti President Jovenel Moise Friday at a private funeral as authorities continue to investigate the July 7th attack at the president's home, where he was shot several times. His wife also seriously wounded. Haiti has been under heightened security since Moise's assassination. Haiti's police chief said 26 suspects have been arrested so far, including 3 police officers and 18 former Colombian soldiers. And the cleanup underway in the storm-ravaged central Chinese city of Zhengzhou following floods that killed at least 33 people in the city and surrounding areas. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Friday, July 23rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's exile opposition leader condemns terrorist charges against Chadema leaders.
This is a dramatic escalation of the crackdown that started last week. And it puts paid to any hope whatsoever that President Samia Suluhu Hassan is a reformist. She is not.
Amnesty International says the arrests of Tanzania's opposition leaders are discriminatory. The British government deports 14 Zimbabwean nationals for various crimes. Liberia's health ministry turns down its $7,500 donation to fight COVID-19. And the U.S. donates 25 million COVID-19 vaccines to Africa.
Our response is but the latest in a long record of U.S. cooperation with African partners in enhancing Africa's health security, whether through PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, and so many other areas.
And the first openly transgender Miss South Africa contestant calls for end to discrimination. The stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Exiled Tanzanian opposition leader Tundu Lissu says the arrests this week of opposition Chadema party leaders is a dramatic escalation of the crackdown on opposition leaders in the country and diminishes any hope that President Samia Suluhu Hassan is a reformist. In fact, Lissu says President Suluhu Hassan is a continuation of the despotism that was the character of the late President John Magufuli's administration. Tanzanian police arrested opposition Chadema president Freeman Mbowe and other party leaders on Wednesday for organizing a meeting to discuss a new constitution. But on Thursday, the police said Mbowe would face charges of conspiracy to commit terrorist acts and killed government officials. Lissu says the allegations are intended to tarnish Mbowe's 10 consistent years as a leader of the largest political party in Tanzania.
This is a dramatic escalation of the crackdown that started last week, and it puts paid to any hope whatsoever that President Samia Suluhu Hassan is a reformist. She is not. She is just a continuation of the obnoxious despotism that was the characteristic feature of the Magufuli regime under which she served as the vice president. What these terror charges mean is that the international community should wake up and take action urgently to make sure that Tanzania does not go the way of Zimbabwe, that Tanzania does not become yet another failed state in Africa.
So, Mr. Lissu, where do you think the government is coming from with these allegations of terrorism and assassination against Mr. Mbowe?
Mr. Mbowe has been the leader of the official opposition in parliament for 10 years. He is the chairman of the largest opposition party in the country. The allegations of terrorism are just utter nonsense. They're just intended to punish him for building the largest opposition party in the country and for being consistent as a Democrat in the struggle for a better Tanzania.
Soon after President Samia Suluhu Hassan came to power, she extended a hand of cooperation to the opposition, and I know that the opposition also did the same. What do you make of these latest developments in terms of the future of the country?
It is true that we have reached out to the president soon after she was sworn in. We as a party wrote to her asking for a meeting to discuss the future of Tanzania, because after 5 years of Magufuli reign of terror, the country needs a new direction, and we thought we should be the ones to extend a hand of dialogue. She then made a public statement that she will be meeting with the political opposition. She has not done so in the 4 months she has been president. And now it seems the answer to our demands for constitutional reform, for dialogue, the answer is to lock us up, to lock our national leaders. In other words, the message that the president is giving to us in the opposition and is sending out to the world is we should not expect anything in the nature of a democratic opening under her watch. It is not acceptable to we in the political opposition. It should not be acceptable to the international community. And therefore, our call to the people of Tanzania is to take any and all action in their power to ensure that we put an end to this autocracy. To our friends and development partners in the international community, we ask them to take a position in support of democracy.
Tundu Lissu is Tanzania's exiled opposition leader. You are speaking with us from TNN, Belgium. Amnesty International says the arrest of Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party leaders is aimed at harassing and intimidating critics of the government. The international rights group says the arrests were selective and will limit the political space in the East African country. Police say Frimo Umboy, national chairman of Chadema, and other leaders were arrested for illegal assembly. Chadema says the meeting was called to discuss a new constitution and did not require police permission. Roland Ibole is Amnesty International's researcher on Tanzania. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the arrest of the opposition leaders is disappointing and discriminatory.
The position of the organization on the arrest is one, it was arbitrarily done. We're also talking about arrests that were done a night or morning to a constitutional convention that had been organized by the opposition party, meaning that we are seeing this as a political arrest, intimidation, and harassment of leaders. And so we are saying as well is that if the 12 have done any offense under the law, then they should actually be charged in court with a recognizable offense.
The police are saying that they were arrested for unauthorized assembly, although the opposition party says they organized a convention for an internal party discussion, which does not necessarily mean that they have to inform the police. How do you address that?
That is an interesting presentation by the police, because one, I've just mentioned that the 12 were arrested while they were sleeping in their hotel rooms at 2:30 a.m. in the morning. One, how is that an illegal assembly? And also, if it is a preemptive arrest, then it should be a preemptive arrest for, a criminal act. Now, there are no laws regarding such kind of assemblies or laws that prohibit such kind of internal party assemblies. What we have was a ban by President Magufuli. So whatever force they are using in terms of reason to arrest these people is not pegged in law.
Some people are saying they are disappointed with the arrest of the opposition leaders because they expected the political space to be opened, particularly when the president replied to the opposition party's letter for meeting to address concerns that they have due to what they said, the narrowing of the political space during the former president Magufuli's time. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
Those criticisms are totally justified because everyone expected some level of tolerance, and especially political tolerance. You know, that olive leaf that we saw from President Suluhu really, got people not just in Tanzania but in the region, it gave them optimism that, things are changing in Tanzania. And so with this arrest, I would say that it is really disappointing that we are returning to those ages whereby a political leader would be arrested 12 hours later or more, you would not know where they are. And the reasons for the arrest would actually be flimsy. We are seeing some form of discriminatory practice, because if you went to Mwanza and saw, how people are living and conducting themselves, and then you hear a top political leader has been arrested because of flaunting COVID-19 rules, then you would know that there was some form of selective application of this law to target this individual. So it is true that people are really questioning and disappointed that this is happening at this time.
Roland Ibole is Amnesty International's researcher on Tanzania. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. The U.S. coordinator for global COVID-19 response says the first donation of 25 million vaccines to Africa will help fight the Delta variant that is causing much of the recent deaths on the continent. Speaking at a briefing this week, Gail Smith said President Joe Biden's promise of 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine will start to arrive in Africa next month. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In the coming weeks, Burkina Faso, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Gambia and Senegal will share some 25 million Pfizer, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines to curb the spread of the pandemic across the continent. Gail Smith, the U.S. State Department Coordinator for Global COVID-19 Response, says her government is ready to do more to make sure Africa gets enough vaccines to give to its people.
We are continuing to share doses. We are pressing other countries to do more, whether through financial contributions to COVAX or sharing their own doses to bring those online as quickly as possible. And we have Pfizer and AU doses coming on in August. So we are expecting, but we're all going to have to work at this, an increasingly regular supply. But it's going to take a lot of time and energy to do that.
COVAX is a global initiative with a goal to distribute vaccines to low and middle income countries. Smith says 500 million Pfizer doses promised by President Joe Biden's administration and Africa will get 60 million in August. Africa has vaccinated 1.3% of the 1.3 billion people living on the continent. Akuna Cook is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Cook says the current donation of vaccine is part of the U.S. government's initiative to support Africa's health sector.
Our response is but the latest in a long record of U.S. cooperation with African partners in enhancing Africa's health security, whether through PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, the Global Health Security Agenda on Ebola, maternal and child health, and so many other areas. All of this is part of our commitment to Africa's health infrastructure, an infrastructure that is helping us meet the demands of this COVID response.
On July 1st, the American government, with the help of German and French development banks, gave $712 million to Aspen Pharmacare, a South Africa-based company, to produce 400 million Johnson & Johnson vaccines for Africa. The three countries also support another pharmaceutical company in Senegal to produce vaccines for Africa. Strive Masiyiwa is the African Union Special Envoy on COVID-19 and coordinator of the African Vaccine Acquisition Trust. Speaking at an online news briefing, he said production of vaccines in Africa can help the continent vaccinate its population easily.
We want to make clear to all suppliers, as I have told them, that if you want a long-term future with us now, you produce from Africa. We don't mind. You can, if you want land, we'll give you. If you want to own everything 100%, we don't mind. Just produce from the African continent. Because when we got into trouble this time, it was because there was no production from the African continent.
The African Vaccine Acquisition Trust, an AU effort supporting vaccination efforts on the continent, said Aspen will supply 10 million vaccines in August and end production of 400 million doses by September 2022. The continent's public health agency said last week Africa recorded 283,000 new infections and at least 6,000 deaths, a 12% increase from previous week. COVID-19 is a disease caused by the coronavirus. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 23rd. Liberia's health ministry has returned a $7,500 donation from an opposition senator that is meant to buttress the fight against COVID-19. As Rita Jilobwe reports from Monrovia, the contribution was returned this week, accompanied by a letter from the health minister.
On June 10, 2021, Liberian lawmakers received $15,000 each as initial payments of $30,000 legislative engagement fund. The public reacted strongly against the lawmakers receiving $30,000 each, when the country's health system was said to be overwhelmed by the coronavirus. As a result, Montserrat County Senator Darius Dillon, a member of the opposition collaborating political parties, donated $7,500 to the Ministry of Health. The donation was made on June 18, 2021, through the Montserrat County Health Team. Few days after Senator Dillon's gesture, rumors surfaced that President George Weah had instructed the Minister of Health to return the money. On Tuesday, July 20, Montserrat County Health Officer Dr. Yata Wapu returned the $7,500 at the National Legislature, along with a letter from the Minister of Health. In her letter to Senator Dillon, Health Minister Wilhelmina Njala said the Ministry of Health could not accept such donation from the senator or any other legislator due to what she called huge public outcry about the source and purpose of the money. Receiving the money on behalf of Senator Dillon, Abel Plaki, political officer of the senator, expressed dissatisfaction in the Liberian government.
Senator Dillon takes seriously the well-being of our people. In his magnanimity, he decided to donate this money to save life. Unfortunately, the government of Liberia has politicized the health of our people.
Plaki says the money was returned because it came from an opposition lawmaker.
While our people are dying, when you can't find paracetamol, ASA in the hospital, the government is returning a goodwill from a senator only because he is an opposition senator.
Since news of the returned $7,500 book, citizens have been condemning the action of the Liberian government through the Ministry of Health.
Fight the virus, forget about politics. Even opposition do good, we should accept it because we are fighting the virus.
Bro, it's not just about CDC or United Party.
That money can be used to even buy something, clean it. I feel bad. I almost shed tears. Not so happy because we need our money in our health sector.
I'm a citizen, but what the fact supposed to be said, we should say it.
Health Minister Wilhelmina Njala has declined to address allegations that she was instructed by President George Weah to return the $7,500 donation back to Senator Dillon. Rita Jrabwe, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
The British government on Wednesday night deported 14 Zimbabwean nationals described by the Home Office in London as convicted foreign criminals. This follows what the Home Office says is a historic landmark agreement between the two nations to send some Zimbabweans back home. In a tweet, the Home Office said the 14 deportees were sentenced to over 75 years in prison for various crimes, including rape and murder. The 14 arrived early Thursday morning at the Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport aboard a charter plane. Andrew Nyamanyaro, one of the attorneys representing the deportees, tells Viewers Zimbabwe service reporter Gibbs Dube that they are bracing for more deportations.
Originally, it was 50 people that were intended to be deported, but after some legal fight, some got injunctions, some removal directions were deferred. However, this morning it is confirmed that 14 people have now been deported to Zimbabwe.
Is 14 people out of 50 were supposed to be deported? So how did it come to that?
So it came to that number because people mounted legal challenges. People submitted judicial reviews, application for injunctions. They made new or fresh claims. We also understand that at one of the detention centers, there was an outbreak of COVID and some of the people had came into contact with people who were positive. So I think those who were in contact with the people who were positive, we also had to be left behind, as per our understanding.
So for those that have gone back home, what are the indications there? Is there anyone being, intimidated or any sort of that thing?
I think it's early days, it's early times, because it's just a few hours that they have landed.
Going forward, what is going to happen to some of those that are supposed to be deported? And we're told there were supposed to be 150 in total. So what's going on now?
So the agreement between the two countries is that every month, the figure it should be either 150 or 100 every month, starting with people who have been convicted of crimes. in the United Kingdom, and then ultimately coming to people that have breached immigration rules, who are not criminals necessarily, but who do not have a legal stay in the United Kingdom. Those people as well are going to be removed eventually.
The British Home Office is saying that, you know, they've got all the legal rights to deport murderers, rapists, and people that break the law. Is that not the case for these Zimbabweans?
That's quite an important question that you've just asked. Every community, every country has got a right to live peacefully and to protect its citizens. And where someone commits an offense, then especially serious offenses, then that is against public policy and that is against public interest. But it's a balancing exercise of where someone has committed an offense. There's a lot of factors to consider. It could be the severity of the offense. It could be whether it's a first-time offense, a second-time offense. Some of the cases that where there is young people who came to the United Kingdom, maybe aged 10, 11, to join their parents. Unfortunately, they then joined bad friends and they've been convicted of, say, drug cases.
Andrew Nyamanyaro is an attorney representing Zimbabwean immigrants living in Britain. He was speaking with reporter Gibbs Dube of VOA's Zimbabwe service. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games, as one of the strangest Olympics in history will get off to an equally unusual start when the Tokyo 2020 opening ceremony takes place in front of thousands of empty seats on Friday. Just 1,000 dignitaries will be present at the 68,000-seat Olympic Stadium for the traditional extravaganza, usually a time of celebration for the host nation. This time around, after a year's pandemic delay, the Japanese public is largely locked out and distrustful of the games, fearing an influx of infections from the foreign visitors. Yet the International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach repeated his call for support from the Japanese public for the Olympic.
You know, what we can do only is to try to get the attention of these people and to try to enter into a dialogue with these people to get not only the emotions across, but also to try, you know, to gain the confidence and their confidence in these strict COVID measures.
Asked whether there is any room to consider admitting spectators to the Tokyo Games, Bach said that organizers and the IOC will continue to monitor the coronavirus situation and reconvene a meeting if circumstances change.
We will keep monitoring the anti-COVID developments, and if there the circumstances should change, that then we will have another immediate meeting, five parties meeting, to address this with the relevant anti-COVID-19 measures.
The Tokyo 2020 organizers are expected to host a banquet on Sunday welcoming Bach and other delegates, despite a state of emergency in Tokyo drawing criticism. There will be 204 nations taking part in this year's games, with North Korea boycotting and the Republic of Guinea withdrawing. Meanwhile, some events of the 2020 Olympics is already underway. Frank Casey of AC Milan scored to give Ivory Coast a 2-1 win over Saudi Arabia in the Olympic Games encounter on Thursday at the Yokohama International Stadium, while Egypt held Spain in the day's earlier kick-off. South Africa under-23 football team kicked off the football event with a 1-0 loss to Japan. The SA under-23 team will next be in action against France on Sunday, 25th of July. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.